TLS is go for main engine start.
Go at throttle up. Negative return. Then we see a nominal Miko. Welcome to space.
We're here. Welcome to the first. This is a bit of a weird one, Anthony. We're doing something a little bit different today.
I'm 95% sure I'm doing it right.
You're not good. Okay. Well, hopefully we'll find out. So listeners, viewers, if you're watching and hearing this, Anthony did it right. So that's good. but yeah, so we're trying out a bit of a not live situation. So I think, are we going to try and like air this when it normally air and like almost like a simulated live? Is that the plan? That's what we're trying to do, right?
We're going to do this like most people do TV. Record it, post it on the time that it goes out. Yeah.
I apologize for my weird schedule.
Oh, it's no problem. No, this is really good.
This was an opportunity for us to test out how to have Australians on our show by not battling time zones. So when this opportunity presented itself, we were like, we've been waiting to try one of these, and we appreciate your time zone, and this is a good time for us. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And as a Canadian and as a person who used to be a British colony as well, I want to help out the Australians, good people.
So you're here with us today, Elizabeth Howell from space.com. We're really excited to have you today because you wrote a book. We're going to talk about your book today. It has got some funky stuff in this book about what happens to your body when you go to space, which is always entertaining. Even like, it's one of those topics where like, even if you read a bunch of stuff you already know, you're just like, oh, that's so cool and weird. Like, it's just like still fun to like, you know, it's one of those kind of things. I don't know what it is about weird stuff that happens to your body, but that's what we're going to talk about today. So did you bring a drink, Elizabeth? I know it's like the middle of the day for you, but I don't know.
Non-alcoholic, I'm afraid, but it's good to get a tea to kind of help you through a long day. And look, I have a special mug. This was given to me by my parents after my first book launch for obvious reasons. So
amazing.
It's kind of like my book mug now. So I guess that's why I got it today.
Awesome. Cool.
I like that. Is that one of those heat activated ones?
No, it should be. Those are the best.
Those are pretty good.
We have one of those in the kitchen, but not today. Today
they're annoying to clean, but
because no dishwasher ever.
Yeah. It's like a single use kind of item. You know,
single use
it's like a hand wash only piece of clothing. You're wearing that once. That's never coming back.
Oh man,
what you got, Jake?
So I went like alcohol light today. So it's still alcoholic, but it's pretty tame.
Oh,
so this is called rompope, which is like kind of like Mexican eggnog. And so it's just got a little cinnamon on top of this.
Real light for the rest of the day.
yeah, I know. No, but it's actually pretty refreshing. So like you put ice in it here and it's, I think what's different is they use just the yolks instead of the whites. Like I think normal eggnog's got both of it, but that's why it's so yellow. But it's really good. It's very sweet and fun. And so they drink it a lot for the holidays around here, but so yeah, cheers.
I went with an Old Steady. We got a perpetual IPA. Boss,
nice.
Bosses can't be mad at me. So
the bosses
can't promise the code quality that's coming out of me later, but
no. Yeah.
What same I will be doing me, is it'll be creative. So that's good. Yeah.
There you go. That's all that matters. Yeah.
Well,
Where do you want to start? Well, I'll start you off here, Lou. So like what, the normal question that pretty much any author gets, why did you write this book? Where did the inspiration come from? And maybe tell us a little bit about your co-author as well, which is probably a pretty big story about how this all came together.
Oh, 100%. So it's me and it's another space person, although it's a person who's literally been to space, Dave Williams. He's got this huge resume and it would take me the entire podcast to talk about it. But he basically is a medical doctor. He's been on some shuttle missions, including a very science and human body focused mission called Neurolab, which has its own textbook. That's how big this mission was. It's like a 200-page textbook you can get off of NASA's website. And so what happened was we were engaging in conversations about my first book, which I was on your podcast for, I believe, Canada Army Collaboration, 4 years ago, almost now. Kind of funny, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, we were talking about it, and Dave very kindly wrote the introduction to it because that particular book was about the Canadian astronaut program. And as we were in conversations, he said, you know what? He said, I've had some ideas for books kind of kicking around, and I was wondering if you'd want to join on. And I was at the time thinking about a book for space medicine, because where we can get into this in the podcast, but it's basically going to be the thing that we have to be thinking about as we're heading to the moon and to Mars, right? Especially the moon, which is like right around the corner, apparently. So anyway, he raised the issue with me, and I said, yeah, I think that's a good idea. Went back to the publisher. And it actually took us another book to get out of the way first. You know, there were that many other things to write, but here we are finally with the result in our hands. And so what I really love about it, though, is that it's drawing upon a person who not only has been in space multiple times, not only has studied it in space multiple times, but also is a doctor here on Earth. And so I think that that triplicate, you know, really allows for an authenticity to the book. And I hope it will be enjoyable, because we did try and have a bit of fun, as you could tell.
Yeah. It's cool. Yeah. Cause Dave Williams is, I think he's like the record holder for Canada's spacewalks and stuff. Like, he's got some pretty cool, he said he's got a huge resume, but like, as far as Canadian astronauts go, it's a pretty good one. So it's really exciting to see you continuing that, that work relationship with him. It's pretty good. Yeah.
The things that he, so was I, obviously he has a background that's particularly interested in this, because it's like all parts of his life combined. So was he the kind of like guiding force of like, these are the issues that are most interesting to astronauts to talk about? These are the things that drive us, you know, kind of mad on the space station because we have to work out for like a billion hours a day. Like, what were the things that he was influential on in the topics of the book?
Well, what was really interesting about the conversation was we were coming at it from two people who have been immersed in space for much of our lives, but in different angles, right? And so he's been on the research side ever since I was born, basically, and probably a bit before, right? Because he was a medical doctor, and then he progressed to the space station. And then he actually was very high up at NASA's Johnson Space Center managing their life sciences program. So he had a lot to do with, from the ground up, essentially, how that was going. And then on my side, I've been a space reporter for about 20 years now. And what that means is that inevitably I did run across health stories, because it's a big feature of trying to keep our astronauts healthy up there, just trying to figure out what's going on, how to be helping them out. And so for me, it was more like, how could I be bringing this to a generalist audience? And then he was really making sure that all the words that I had were scientifically authentic, right? Because you do want to make sure that you're hitting exactly that right terminology, that you're expressing things also with the right error bar. Because the thing about space, unfortunately, is that somebody looks at a study and they're like, oh my God, there's cancer, right? And you're going, there's some nuance to this, you know? There's some nuance to the radiation issue. Yes, we're not, you know, ignoring it, but at the same time, it's not instantly cancer, right? And so it's just good to have somebody sitting there who actually has the medical degree able to check you out, just to make sure that you're not kind of trumping up things where they shouldn't be trumped up, so to speak, and then making sure that you're still staying authentic. Yeah. So it was a really interesting relationship in that regard, because we both were passionate about the topic. We still are, obviously, wrote a whole book about it, but we just had these two different kind of ways of approaching it, me for the generalist and he being like, this is a specialist way of doing it.
Radiation thing's funny, because it's like, the list, if you made a list of all the things you talk about in the book, it's like all of them are more annoying than the current state of radiation science about like what happens to your body in space. It's like your body degrades like instantly in bad ways that are very noticeable and very detrimental to your life, and all this time is spent trying to counteract that through exercise or treatments or the gloves that go in, you know, your spacesuit for spacewalks to like prevent your fingernails from hurting all the time. There's just so much minutia, and clearly from like Dave's perspective, that annoyed him probably day after day after day in space and on Earth. And it's like, we have these long drawn out debates about radiation. Will we ever go to Mars because of the radiation? It's like, well, we might not have fingernails by the time we get there. So is that like, which one of these things is more solvable and worse for us in the like immediate time in front of us? I just find that is an interesting balance.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, one of the things that we were pointing out in the book is some things have been solved, Okay, so you don't solve a big problem in a minute, but at the same time, we have made a lot of progress. And so one of my favorite examples from the International Space Station. So let's just take a step back before I even answer the question. So as probably you well know, the two of you, as well as most of your viewers and listeners, the International Space Station has been in orbit continuously since about 98. Crews have been sitting there since about 2000. And so that means that we essentially have 22 years of continuous human experience and almost a quarter century of, you know, that orbiting experience. And that's on top of whatever came before, right? So we had the Mir space station, we had the Skylab space station, and of course, all the short duration stuff that went up in between to simplify human space history in just a few moments. So anyway,
well done, well done, very good.
You're much like the Chinese space program, just really speed running
right?
It.
Yeah, just... So, exactly, right? But more seriously, what it allowed us to do was to be using the same environment and the same types of experiments over and over again for still a small group of people, but not an insignificant number. And so I'll explain how that works in a second. They sent up this device. You can read about it in the book, but basically it was a muscular device to try and get you doing a simulated weightlifting in orbit. Okay. And the problem with being in orbit is, of course, you're falling all the time. And so you're not going to be able to just bring up your standard set of dumbbells and be done with it, right? You have to take a little bit
creative. You'd look awesome and it would be
very easy.
You'd
look awesome, yeah. But you're still going to be quite the weakling when you get back because there's no resistance, right? And so what they did was they set up essentially, exactly.
Everyone's looking like Victor Glover up there. Just,
yeah. You know, you know what? I could be heroic. I could go and lift 400 pounds, no issue, right? Because it's just, anyway.
You could do the whole space station.
Yeah, through the whole space station, mm-hmm. You know, on camera, it'd be amazing. But what they decided to do was to set up this device, and it essentially used bands. I'm very much simplifying the science here, but it used a strong set of bands. We had this resistance bands that the astronauts were using in orbit. And what they were doing was that it was allowing you to really be just like on Earth, using some kind of resistance to keep your muscles in good shape. But here was the issue. Some of them actually got so good at it up there that they couldn't continue to improve, because that's the thing about exercising, right? You got to continue to improve and continue to work out your body, because if you don't do that, then you just kind of stagnate. You don't get any better. And so they said, you know, it's doing most of the solution, but let's see if we can make it even better. And so now they have a system up there that uses pistons, okay? And there's no way that any human being and possibly many robots would be able to maneuver this piston system. So the long story short is what that allows us to do is to have them come back with stronger muscles, stronger bones. And this may actually be a good treatment for people who have osteoporosis or some kind of a muscular disorder here on Earth in the future. And so what I love about that example is that not only is showing us how space science improves in orbit, but also how we may potentially be able to think of ideas here on Earth to help people who really need it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of like wild stuff like that where just like, because of the nature, like the ubiquitous or the, I guess, the novelty of the problems that you have in space just force a lot of really weird new thinking and things like that. And you can learn a lot of stuff the way, injecting a little bit of chaos into the thought process is always a great way to spark ideas and get stuff. And I don't know, I can't think of anything much more chaotic than taking gravity away. So,
or as Dave loves to point out, having partial gravity. And so what's really interesting now is we have 25 years of space station research and obviously everything that came before, but how long have people been on the moon, right? Just a few weeks, when you really add up all the time, right? Just a few weeks. And so we don't know how systems are going to behave in a sixth of Earth gravity, which is what's on the moon and on Mars. Yeah. And so what happens? You fly the person there in what we call microgravity or zero G, and then they land and they can't get out of their spacecraft to go and fix up the habitat or even a dinner. You know, like, what do we do? So these are pressing questions, right? Yeah, because NASA does want to be sending people back to the moon along with a big contingent of other nations, and then possibly onto Mars maybe in the 2040s or 50s, whenever that happens to be. So I agree. A bit of chaos might be a good thing to figure this stuff out.
Well, plus then you can solve the gross things too. So the one passage that I read which stands out to me was the astronaut describing taking his sock off, and I almost threw up a little bit when I read it because it was so gross. But basically, trying to take the sock off and keep all the foot bits in the sock and not floating around in the space, because they just go, and then, or having to take it off in front of that vent with the air to suck it all in, and then you clean out the foot bits later.
Foot
so
bits. I guess that's why. Foot bits.
Yeah, foot bits.
Chris Hadfield was doing a video a few years ago when he was in space, and it was about cutting your fingernails in space. And so if you read his book, he was talking about the outtake of that particular video. So the video did really well. But the problem was he didn't pay a lot of attention to where the fingernails went after he cut them. And so later on, somebody was finding them in the vents and was a little bit unhappy about that. And so he learned a few things about nail bits or hand bits. I suppose those would be those were bits, you know, foot bits, but
hand bits and foot
not
bits.
Not very good.
Yeah. No, I don't know. It's funny. There's always that. There's the story. Is it Peggy Whitson who was telling all of her like the rookie astronauts who were coming to the station with her? She said, like, you need to go get a pedicure the day before you come, or whatever, you know, whenever you can outside of the quarantine or whatever, because this is like, I'm not having all your foot bits all over the space station when you're up here.
This is why NASA is making exactly all the private astronaut missions fly with a former NASA astronaut to control keep this kind of stuff under wraps
to enforce the ISS pedicure policy.
It's like you see, they see like someone taking a sock off. Wait, stop! You're not in the right spot.
Gross. Yeah. It's gross.
That's really bad. To get us away from that gross topic, related to the exercise, there was for some reason like you inject fun into the book in ways that I find hilarious. But there's also just all these little anecdotes and little factoids, and some of them just hit different for me. There was the section about the treadmill, which is called Colbert, as everyone knows.
Yeah.
I've never heard anyone reference the speed at which that can go, and it can go up to 12 and a half miles an hour, something like that, which I find hilarious that like you can plug in the treadmill and go full sprint in the middle of ISS. And I'm just imagining like going up for your exercise, plugging in and immediately going full power, and you're just in other people's workspace at a full sprint. And it's definitely very noisy, and I had this little scene in my mind of that happening. I'm just like
the Predator run,
the scene from Dumb and Dumber where they're like, it feels like you're running at an incredible pace. It's like that all over again.
Yeah, exactly. And you're bringing up some interesting things about the crew dynamics, right? Because if you have exercise happening in the middle of your living space, it can disturb an experiment if you're not careful, right? You know, or you can disturb somebody's sleep. So that's why they have everything so tightly scheduled up there. And they have to make sure that when they include that, 2.5, 3 hours, whatever it is for somebody to be exercising, it includes the wipe down time, because any of us who've been at a gym on a treadmill know what kind of nastiness may arise from that area, right? And so a lot of it is also about just trying to keep the crew happy, because as big as a space station is, it's not much bigger than a house, right? Typical house it is. So you know how easy it is to get on each other's nerves, even if you're lucky enough to be in a house, let alone an apartment or something smaller, right? You know, those of us with roommates would understand that.
Yeah, it's probably pretty cramped up there when you think about it.
Especially now, there's like these stretches of time with 11 people on there. It's
sleeping in the airlock. Yeah,
sleeping in the airlock is a real experience.
Yeah.
The section that you have about food and drinks and like gastrointestinal digestion and all that kind of stuff was very interesting to me, because it's something that doesn't get talked a lot about, and I find is the thing that that normal people, when we start going to space, will notice the quickest. Like, we're not gonna be on these crazy exercise regimes for the week long trip that we have to orbit. We'll just go to orbit and come back and whatever, but the food will notice like instantly. The bits about if you swallow gas, you can't really burp without other stuff also coming up, which made me think about this announcement from IAC a couple weeks back, which one of the champagne companies was like, we're sending champagne on Axiom 2. And when I read that, I was like, that's a terrible thing to drink in space. Like, we're not going to drink it because it's illegal to drink on the US segment. I'm like, cut the crap. You're going to drink that on the Russian side for sure. What a terrible idea. Like, that has to be, you get the sense from Dave that it is uncomfortable to experience that, or did you not notice? I don't know how to think about the needing to burp in space.
I think there's a couple of things to understand about the astronaut mentality. So first of all, they are super fit to start with, right? So they have that advantage. But also, sometimes you're scheduled down to 5-minute increments. And so, you know how whenever you're running a very busy day at home, or even at your workplace, and you forget to eat, you know, I'm wondering if there might be that aspect of not even noticing minor digestive issues until you're actually sitting down, or not sitting, I guess, floating to do it, so to speak, right? Because they got the toilet there. But certainly if they have any other issues, they can go and talk to their doctor. They actually have this aspect of medical privacy, which is both important and good, you know, because what that allows them to do is to actually raise with the doctor without me, the journalist, listening in and just going, hey, you know, I've got this problem. How can we address it? And then they have a support crew on ground. I'm not sure that a lot of people know that, but whenever something is raised, like it could even be about the workload, let alone about digestive issues that they're having, and they need support, there's this ground crew that kicks in. There's a dedicated astronaut, for example, who interfaces with the family. And there's other astronauts that interface with everybody that has to do with the astronaut's workload on the ground. And they just kick it out, right? And they just figure it out because they figure the person in space doesn't have time to solve it. And so then they put 50 people on the ground trying to fix it on their behalf. And that's how come you can see things happen on time up there. It's simply that huge, huge support team that makes it possible. So you don't really hear much about the individual stuff, but I was really glad that Dave was able to give us some insight as to just what could happen. Maybe later on in a couple of hundred years when some of these privacy studies are not as much of an issue, right? Because the person will have long passed. You may have some fun anecdotes for the future generations.
I thought you were going to say because we've abolished all privacy laws, but...
No. I'm not suggesting that at all. But you know how... Over
it's not
time.
In the Artemis Accords, so... You know.
That stuff from the Cold War is coming out now, right? Because it's not a security issue anymore. So maybe the same with some of the studies. We may have more access than we do now. For
or
that
just
reason.
More hot mics from astronauts like John Young. So
who knows, right?
Hot mics always have some good info. Specifically, the John Young missions had great hot mic moments. So.
Yes, they did. I was going to say the no gas thing is really going to put a cramp on our first on orbit off nominal meetup. That's for sure. Because
we have to only do it in an artificial gravity station. That's the requirement.
Well, there is a new set of commercial stations going up in the 2030s. So who knows? Maybe there might be a little artificial gravity room that you could sit in or stand in, as the case may be.
That's got to happen.
To go
up the burp room. I'm actually interested in like some of the engineering things around that. Like, we're getting into a side tangent, but let's do it because maybe Dave mentioned something about this.
I planned on going here anyway, so let's go for it.
There's like, you know, because I started thinking about, because all these things come up and you're like, well, I feel like gravity helps a lot of this, so let's think about gravity for a minute. There's a conflicting thing with the design of spacecraft, right, where being in zero gravity is cool because you can use the volume much better. Like, you can put stuff on all the walls and on the ceiling and on the floor and in the middle, and you can use all the space really effectively, but it's detrimental to your health in all these different ways. And so part of me is like, could we have zero gravity during your work day, and then everyone goes to sleep and we spin up the station and everyone sleeps at full gravity, and then we flip it back on. So like, you have this little mix, and it's like, is that enough time to recover some of these bad effects, right? Especially when you were talking in the book about astronaut recovery, which I would also like to talk about, being almost day for day. How long were you in space takes you that much time to recover? It's like, okay, so it's like, you know, 10 hours and 10 hours of no gravity and gravity helpful? Does that help you recover and maintain health? Or are you still going to, and this is just stuff that we're never going to know until we actually design some of these stations of like,
no, exactly.
How helpful is gravity? But like, it's just... Yeah. I don't know. It's frustrating that stuff is not, I know it's a huge engineering challenge, obviously, and maybe this is better when we have a moon base that we can live at for lengthy periods of time, so we can do the research there instead of designing our own artificial gravity. But it just feels like something that we don't talk about because it's so hard. And I feel like for people like Dave, maybe it's something he was interested about because of, you know, both half of his brain, the astronaut side and the medical side. What is the sense that you get from the astronaut corps in terms of like, that as a problem they would like to see solved or even just experimented with?
Well, I think that they're focused more on trying to get to the moon and back right now. They're sort of in that operational mode, but certainly I would think that researchers are asking that question themselves. And so I don't quite have the answer, but what I can point to is we do have research that can simulate a little bit what gravity is like or the lack of gravity is like up in space. And so in the book, I believe we talk about bed studies. And so what they do is they put people, and they pay people actually, to stay in bed for weeks or sometimes months at a time. And so maybe what you could try doing is 10 months, it could feel like 10 months in bed, but anyway, 10 hours in bed and then 10 hours out of bed, and then try and simulate it a little bit, because you do see a lot of the same changes. It's not quite the same, obviously, because you're not floating. But if you're there in a head tilted down position, apparently your body almost thinks that it's, you know, relaxed and that there's no reason to be, you know, producing muscle and bones as it usually does. And so we could try that, or we could even just try short ideas, see about ways of simulating microgravity here on Earth. I'm going to be looking into one of those iFly things. I don't know if you're aware of those, but you know, when you're skydiving and you're in free fall, they now have these devices in certain cities where you can go and pretend that you're skydiving for minutes at a time, and you could just be floating around on this big bed of air. And so I'm hoping to try that out in a few months. And I'm thinking that maybe if we could do something like that, maybe not as extreme, you know, that might be another way of trying to think through how to be solving this gravity issue.
If you need other people to experiment that with, I would totally go iFlying for hours on end.
No, but it's, I mean, you're bang on, Anthony, because like, I noticed that too, because I think I got, it was like almost, it was halfway through the book before, like, because the book sort of presents all these different, you know, challenges you face in space. And you had to get halfway through before you found one that wasn't gravity induced. Like it was, you know, there's so many things, like gravity.
Yeah.
I didn't even think of it that way, but you're right. I'm just looking at the table of contents.
It's pretty far in.
We get to about chapter 9 before we begin talking about microbes and interplanetary protection. But the rest of it is eyes, balance, food, you know, skin. You know, a lot of it's microgravity induced. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Good job.
Yeah. I'll try and like ask this maybe in a different way because it's interesting. Yeah. But it's like, you know, it does. Do you, and this is maybe a your opinion thing, not a Dave thing, but like, are we, like, should we be spending so much time focusing on all this microgravity stuff? Like, is this the right path? Like, to, like, I don't know. When I think about if we ever want to go to far out worlds, Mars, wherever, and we have these long journeys, like, is the right idea to solve microgravity so we can float around and not suffer any ill effects? Or should we just put gravity back in? And like, is that an easier problem to solve? And I just like, I can't quite answer that question myself. And I just keep asking myself over and over and over again. And I don't know if you have a thought on it or a stance.
I think it's like the Coke versus Pepsi type of debate. You know, there's a lot of ways you could go in both directions, right? I think that for now we should try and pursue both and then I guess see which one makes the most sense. And so it may make the most sense in terms of cost or infrastructure. But it's funny too, like you do look at the science fiction and a lot of it points to artificial gravity. Without giving away too many spoilers, if you look at the latest season of For All Mankind, they're sitting in these vessels that are going very long distances. I won't say where, but anyway, it seems to be an artificial gravity environment, shall we say. And that actually is a huge plot point in the pilot, not the pilot, but the premiere episode of the new season about the effects of gravity on the human body. So maybe go and check that out or something like The Expanse, just to get some ideas.
Expanse does it so well too, especially with like, you know, the people that grew up on series and then they're all super tall and lanky and they do such a good job of showing the extended, you know, extended periods of time and what the effects are theoretically.
Exactly. You can torture them just by bringing them to Earth. Yeah. Like that's
Or even remember like when the Martians came to Earth, they take like the drugs to like get them ready for 1G. Like there's so many interesting bits there. That's like, that's a plausible thing that could exist in 200 years for sure. Your question, is such a Jake question. And I love it because let's like run the parallel path there. Right. We launched the space station in 2000 and we spent 22 years and $100 billion building an artificial gravity station instead of microgravity research. Like if you gave me $100 billion in 20 years, I feel like I could probably do an artificial gravity thing. Like I feel
probably,
confident about that.
Yeah.
and yeah, it's like, damn. Like maybe that was the right one. I don't know.
That's the sort of like cynical follow-on question, right? It's just like, are we only spending so much time trying to figure out how to deal with microgravity because we have a microgravity station and it's not going anywhere? We're not building anything new. Like, is this sort of like a when you have a hammer, every problem's a nail? Like, you know, I don't know. Like, it's an interesting, you know, question to.
It is. And bearing in mind, I'm not an engineer. A little I know would tell me that it just seems to be hard from what we can tell to simulate artificial gravity up there because they have done it in a limited set of experiments. And it just seems to require either a really big beam or a lot of spinning and people get sick, you know?
Yeah.
And
that's why I'm interested about the sleeping thing, because a big part of it is like to spin the whole station up, you need a really long distance, right? Not the ISS. It's a bad design for spinning it up, but like think about, you know, two starships attached to each other, spin those up. You need a really long distance, because you're moving about within the spacecraft. So you don't want these huge differences of if you're over there, you're in like, you know, 1/3 gravity, and down here you're in 1G, and it's dizzying to go between that. But if you're just laying there, you're just sleeping, and we design it so that it's like half G at, you know, the level where you're sleeping and no one's moving around. I don't know. Maybe it's a little bit like getting on Mission to Mars or Mission Space or whatever the ride is in Disney and like turning your head to the side, you know, like you're sleeping. Yeah, and all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, this is a terrible experience.
You know, I feel like we need to be in a Star Trek world where we're not having the economic issue, right? Because it's just a matter of trying to figure out how to be launching that much stuff into space.
Yeah.
So, you know, then, you know, the engineers would probably say, oh, you could do in situ resource utilization, which means using the stuff that you have on hand, or, you know, you can have the robots build out the stuff in orbit. But again, we're only talking small scale demonstrations at this point. So I kind of wish that in a sense that could be brought back again in 150 years, even just to see how we're solving this. Like, we're at the beginning. And I think that you're right. We may have to pick a direction, you know, once we sort of see where the engineering is leading us.
Mm-hmm. I feel like the best bet is just get to the moon and see how 1/3 or 1/6 is. Like, let's see how that works out.
I mean, it's not a bad strategy either, right? Because it's something you can do now and go for it. But I don't know. I almost wonder though if it's just going to take one of these like crazy, you know, newer space companies to just come out and be like, we're doing artificial gravity, and just kind of plow through it and get it up there and fly it, and then it's like, okay, yeah, this is actually better. And then finally drag everybody else kicking and screaming into that world, you know? I don't know. So I guess Blue Origin, Nanoracks, get on it. I want to see some funky ideas on the
Orbital Reef looks like the one that would look best with a spinning ring attached to one end of it. Like just right? Visually, that's got the vibe. Yeah, there's big windows. You can watch the ring spin by.
One on each side though, right? Otherwise you'll get that funky off-kilter thing.
Yeah.
The Zenny Bekov effect, right? So Elizabeth, going through all this stuff, all the weirdness that happens to your body, getting taller, your eyes going all funky, what's one that stood out to you as like the weirdest or most surprising? Like what's the one that you had maybe the most joy or interest in researching and writing about?
Well, as somebody who's wearing glasses and entering that phase where my eyes are doing interesting things even here on Earth, you know, I got some questions about how we're going to be managing eyesight in space, because we talk about it at length in the book, so I'm not going to try and replicate, you know, our peer-reviewed, so to speak, research in there. But essentially, the issue was that the eye seems to change shape a little bit, and we're trying to figure out exactly in what way and why and how we can counteract that. But the practical effect is that people like Bob Thirsk, another Canadian, have gone up there and have openly said that when they came back, they didn't have the same reading ability that they did before. Now, I've got to be careful. It's not like you're blind, okay? But they're just seeing little changes. You know, maybe they could read 10-point font and now they're down to 12, you know, or something of that nature, right? And so we are a long ways along the road of fixing that issue, because clearly they've been looking at it for many years, and there's a number of studies we cite in the book to be doing that. But I just think that when it comes to trying and help our senior people here on Earth, or even those in remote environments that have eye issues, trying to solve an issue like that could be life-changing for a lot of people, like not just a few of us who get to go up there, but also those of us who are, you know, even just trying to face normal aging. I know people who have had cataract surgery. You know, that's a normal aspect of being a human being, even here on Earth, and up in space where you're exposed to radiation, it might be that much worse. And so that's something that I just find really fascinating, those little things like that. Like, you wouldn't even think about your eyes, right? You're just up there, you're looking at things, right? But it turns out that even that tiny little set of organs can undergo profound changes from a few months in orbit. So, yeah, that it was just things like that that struck me, and the nails. But, you know, the little things, I guess, is really what got me.
What was I wrote it down, the name of what happens if you get your nails screwed up on a spacewalk. I'm never gonna be able to pronounce that. Biomechanically induced spacewalkers. What the hell is that next word? Onychoschisia.
Onychoschisia.
Do you remember this word that you wrote down, Elizabeth?
Now, that's a challenge. You know, what I do as a journalist is I always just go and I check with the study again on Google. And so I'm hoping that it's the same spelling as whatever the study we were citing there. And then we're in good sense. And the other thing that I would say is that it's an old joke, but I'm a print journalist. I'm not a TV journalist, which obviously is an aged sort of analogy. But that means that I have the luxury of saying, I don't know how to pronounce things, but I can't spell them. Right?
So true.
Yeah.
Very accurate. Yeah. 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 No, the eyes is like a, I don't know. It feels bad. I don't know. I have like some like human health anxiety about space travel, and eyes are definitely one of those things where I'm just like, I don't know if we can do this, guys. Like, the eyes really get messed up, and that seems like an important thing to take with us when we go to Mars. Yeah.
So, and yeah, one that just kind of feels like, it just feels like one of those problems that gets bad slowly and then very quickly, you know? And I don't want to be like 18 months into a very long Mars mission when all of a sudden, boom, I can't really see anything anymore. It's like, ooh, I don't, that gives me some strife.
Yeah.
But maybe the 1/3 gravity when you get there is fine.
Maybe it's
exactly.
Enough,
I mean, maybe it might be a bit easier once you get to partial gravity. But again, how many weeks of research have we had in partial gravity with humans? And to be fair, also to the Apollo astronauts, as extraordinary as their missions were, they didn't have a lot of time to be doing medical experiments, right? They were running around collecting rocks because that was their mandate. So it would be a very different focus these days. And we also have to remember that the measurement tools weren't as good simply in the 60s as they are today. One of my favorite examples being that they looked at some rock samples, because they still have some kind of set aside, and they discovered water, you know, evidence of sort of water molecules within them. And they're going, but we looked at these before in the 60s and 70s, and we didn't see anything. But it's because the technology for looking at what's inside of them has changed so much. So I think it'll be very, very interesting when they land down there, just the kind of experiments that they're able to do compared to what the Apollo astronauts were capable of.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's a really good point, like with the time. So even if we have all this Apollo experience, like just what we knew about science back then, you know, because I always think about this, the rock side of it, the picking up the rocks thing, like 1960s, at that point in time, plate tectonics were like a pretty new radical thing that like there were still like geoscientists probably showing up to the Apollo, you know, science conventions who weren't quite on board with plate tectonics yet. Right. And that's like such a ubiquitous normal thing for us now. And so, you know, what are all the versions of plate tectonics that are in human health from the 60s as well is like pretty interesting to me to try and understand. All the gene therapy stuff that we never had back then, like all that kind of stuff. Right. There's just like crazy amount of things we can learn. So
exactly. And as we start to land other genders on the moon as well, because obviously everybody so far has been a man, I'd be really interested to see what happens then, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very limited data set for sure.
But we did our best, you know. Again, I grew up loving Apollo. You can't see it because the camera's in the opposite direction, but I got Apollo 13, the movie poster, right in front of me. And it sort of was a constant reminder about
Saturn
what got
back
me.
There. I could see it.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, but I got the Saturn behind me, and I got some other
and you got
Apollo
Upgar
hardware.
5
you can see.
Over there?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Upgar 5 just over here. Yeah, exactly. So I think that they're a leading light. They're a good inspiration about what kind of science we can do with the state of the art of the day, because, you know, people in 60 years are going to be laughing at us too and going, oh, well, my goodness, you didn't know anything about gene therapy back then, right? You know, so I also want to be fair to them and just say they did a tremendous job. And I've been lucky enough to talk to a few of those folks, but I'm also just really interested in seeing, okay, we know this part, how much more, you know, can we do building on their research? And so that's really fun, you know, getting somebody involved in there who's citing papers now from 60 years ago from the Apollo program, and then sort of seeing, oh, yeah, we have come far away, because the advances have been tremendous, obviously, since that time.
Hopefully the people in 2080 aren't looking back at us being like, yeah, those idiots were trying to do microgravity. What were they thinking?
Honestly, okay, I was going to get into something like that here. Yeah. When I read, you know, a write-up of all these different problems that we're figuring out in space, sometimes I can read each section individually and be like, ah, kind of a bummer that we haven't figured this one out yet, like in terms of how to address it best. But also, like, it's hard to quantify what is the value of the knowledge that we have about what happens when people go live in space for a while. Because if you are somebody like myself who believes in like the long-term vision of expanding humans out into the solar system and whatever else, like at some point we need to do that. We need to figure out what it's like to live somewhere for a while. And it's one of the cases where it's like, that shouldn't be like, what is the ROI for figuring out that treadmills and cycles were the things that we wanted to bring to the space station? It's, we just had to figure it out at some point. And so when I look at the Artemis program and Jake and I sit here and have all these people on to debate, like, why are we doing this program? What are we going to do when we get there? At the end of the day, I'm like, just go live there for a while. Just go hang out for like a month or two. See what happens. I don't know what's going to happen to you. You don't know what's going to happen to you. If you're game to go live there for a month or two, go live there. Let me know what happens, how it feels. Like that's a valuable thing, even if you can't quantify, oh, we spent $10 billion on this particular program. But if you're interested in the long-term development, we got to do that. We got to figure out what it's like to live places. And I'm coming to ease with the fact that like the value is we went and lived there for a while. And that's as good as it needs to be. That probably rankles Jake a little bit in the why are we doing human spaceflight thing. You're in a dark place again with the human spaceflight. I saw some of your Discord posts. I saw some of those.
Yeah. I'm a little bummed right now. But I'm not bummed about the idea of it. I'm bummed about the execution of it. So it's different. I think your thought is good. Cause at least then you're defining you can argue how much value that has, but you're still saying, here's the value that we want. Let's go do it. It's very declarative and good in that way. So
well, it's also I'm all for our conversation about artificial gravity. Like we could be 3 months into Artemis living on the moon and be like, oh wow, we don't need 1G things to build in space anymore. All of our stuff can be, you know, taken down to like 1/6G. Maybe 3 months is kind of short, but 3 years, 10 years into it, and say, boy, all the stuff that we had, you know, all these sci-fi movies have to rewrite their stuff because they were all spinning up to 1G, and 1/6 is plenty fine. Let's just go with that. And it makes the engineering of the future spacecraft so much easier if that's the case.
Well, that's it, right? Because if you want to go all the way back to Mercury, they were asking, can people swallow while they're in microgravity?
Yeah, right.
These were legitimate questions. Can people swallow?
If you go back further than that, it's like, will you explode into a million pieces if you break the sound barrier? Was like a thing that we were definitely afraid of, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So you're right. We may find something that surprises us. And to get back to the humans and robots, remember with Artemis, at least they're going to be working together. You know, it's not like they're going to be by themselves. It's going to be kind of like Perseverance and Ingenuity, the rover and the little drone on Mars that are doing their thing together. But this time you throw humans in the mix. So at least we're not only doing one or the other, just picking one path. We're going to say, let's try and integrate because then we can use the best of both worlds, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As long as the humans aren't flying the drones, because they're humans are bad at that. How quickly would we have crashed Ingenuity if you and I were driving it, Jake? Like,
I'm not an astronaut yet anyway, you know, but I'm sure if we got Dr. Dave Williams in the conversation, he would point out that there are many trained pilots in the program.
That's true. But I have 100% confidence that if you gave anyone a controller to a drone on Mars, they would crash it in like within the day. They would crash that shit. They'd be like, I bet I could fly through that skinny opening in those rocks. Like, let's try to get right through there and slam it right into
Ingenuity flight was like this, right? It just went up a few inches and then went back down.
We would never do that. We would go, all right, let's see how high and fast we can go on the first one.
Yeah, how far can you make it to that ridge and back? I'll race you and it'll just go right. Yeah. So you could argue that it won't be because of incompetence, but it'll still happen.
Oh, no, they would be great pilots, but they would do human things, you know?
No, exactly. What you're arguing is the hubris problem, which goes all the way back at least to the ancient Greeks. So that's a different aspect.
Yes, the hubris problem. Well, what else, Elizabeth? Is there anything about this book that we haven't touched on that you think is like important to tell listeners about, or if they're gonna go get this book, what should they look forward to? What did we miss? Is a good question.
Well, you know, I think that we already have kind of touched on this, but I do want to sort of hammer on it because for me, when I'm trying to write something, I'm trying to think about how to be engaging somebody new. A lot of the people that come across our website at space.com are actually new readers. You know, they haven't arrived there before. And so I'm always trying to think about how to be grabbing somebody who's a bit younger. I mean, for me, it was a movie, Apollo 13, that first got me involved. And so what kinds of games or virtual reality or whatever are going to be grabbing a young person? And I think that all this conversation we've been having about sci-fi is another way of thinking about it. And so I'm hoping that the aspects that we had in one of the last chapters, which is about tricorders and holodecks, is grabbing classic Star Trek stuff that thankfully is still relevant because they're coming out with a series with what feels like every 2 months now. It's incredible. Yeah. Lower Decks, anybody? I mean, I love that. It's just incredible, the inclusivity of that particular series. It's making the older Star Treks look quite, quite different these days. And so I felt that that was really important to include in the book because I was also trying to think about both about how to future-proof us a little bit, just to say, hey, even if we don't have the answers, we can see it in sci-fi, you know, and they have some sort of path along the way to answering those questions, but also to be trying to think about how to bring in new people. Because for me, I always think that space, and pretty much anything else, you know, benefits by having a diversity of folks in here, and that we need to get the younger people interested. That way they can come in with their, you know, amazing tech skills that I can't even imagine and go in here. Like, it's really fun watching my friends' kids play videos, like just, you know, normal videos. So I don't know about YouTube, but I came from the VHS era, right? And so if you went back and forth too many times, you'd literally break the tape. Whereas these kids, they're watching videos and they actually skip through out of sequence into the areas that they feel are of the most interest and they replay them. It's just a completely different way, you know, way of looking at things. And so that's why I really like engaging with younger folks and trying to bring in the sci-fi analogies, because it's another way of kind of bending your brain or even breaking it sometimes to good.
Yeah. Well, and like as sort of a follow on to that, like there, you know, you bring up the example in the book of the, of like nuclear propulsion example as like today it's still just slightly out of reach, but it's like achievable, you know, like we don't have it yet, but it feels like we can get it if we really want it. And that is a thing where maybe that solves, you know, some of the health problems we talked about, because if we want to go to Mars, the big challenge is going to be the 6 months of zero G on the way there. But what if it's only 7 weeks or something, you know? And then like, if you could just, the best part is no part, that whole issue, you know, like just remove the whole thing and
no, exactly. And it's funny, you just brought up something in my mind. And so since the book was published, or rather written and then published, because it's publishing right now, but we finished it about a year ago, right? There have been so many developments in hypersonic vehicles just in the past year that you could almost do another book about that, hint, hint. But anyway, it's just been incredible. Now, most of it obviously is on the military side for now, but we're going to be seeing, I think, a commercialization of this over time. Because usually what happens is you get a big anchor customer like NASA or the military working on it first, and then it tends to proliferate. Same with rocketry, right? It did have military origins. And so I'd be really interested to see whether that research could translate into trying to get us some faster vehicles in general for spaceflight. So maybe we get to the moon in 30 minutes, you know, instead of 3 days, which would be amazing. Mm-hmm. And then we get over to Mars in a few months or a few weeks rather than what we got right now. So who knows?
Yeah. Okay.
And if you can figure out a way to provide that thrust en route, that's just enough artificial gravity, then you're good.
Exactly. You go. You're good. Yeah. Like that solves two problems at the same time.
Thrust all the way there at 0.16 G. It's your moon ship.
Totally different kind of thing, but
yeah.
To throw back to my previous scenario, when you're sleeping, you're thrusting. And when you're not sleeping, you're not thrusting. Like, boom, now we're good. Sleep under thrust, you know? It's good. Run that one through your models, Jake.
Yeah, I'm working on it. Mm-hmm. processing. I feel like there's like a really dirty joke in here somewhere, but I can't put it together, so I'm going to let it go right by.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, where should people be shopping?
Where, are you where should people be shopping? Okay, well, support your local bookstore first. You'd be surprised. Many of them do have robust websites, but if you can't do that or prefer to really be specific, go to ECW's website. You can see it up there in the video now, and it should be in the show notes, I hope, once we're finished.
Already is,
And then, perfect, because then that gets a pretty small publisher some much-needed dollars. And, you know, I'm really glad that you all took the time to speak to me, because, you know, I really recognize that I'm just like the person on the cover, but that there were a bunch of other folks at ECW that helped us out. I got to give a shout out to all of the, you know, people doing the cover design, which is gorgeous. I had no, you know, I had input into it, but I certainly didn't have the skills. I'm a stick figure person, right? But I mean, look at it.
Yeah.
Isn't it playful?
It's great.
Yeah, I totally dig it. And the L, you know, stuck on the person's head because he or she or they are, it's growing taller. It's great, you know? So, you know, we had the cover design, we had the people who did the layout, we had the people who did the editing. That was a huge process in itself, right? Just trying to marry, so to speak, two co-authors' ideas into one and make it sound like we're one person. So I really am appreciative for everybody's, you know, help. It took a year to get this thing shepherded, even after Dave and I finished it. So thanks to you too and everybody else who was involved.
How was it?
Now,
this is your... Is this your second published, third published in this format?
Actually, it's number five, if I may dare to say.
Five,
yeah. And Dave is on, I keep losing track, something like 7 or 8. And he can do two kinds of books. He can do kids' books and he can do adult books. And those are completely different, as most people would know. So it was good to have somebody who just knows the industry in that sense and was able to bounce off ideas. Because, you know, being like any astronaut, he can do 10 things excellently. So
that's a requirement.
Just the way it goes, right? You know,
I hate that about astronauts. It infuriates me.
Is this
the people that got become doctors and they get bored, so they also become fighter jets.
I should show you. I had his Wikipedia up earlier, and let's just finish on this. If you go to his Wikipedia page,
decided to pick up a few engineering degrees on the weekend.
Look at how many letters are after this dude's name.
I know.
What is going on here? What is this?
Yeah, I know.
Unbelievable.
I don't know what any of that
is. And the problem was we had to pick what to put on the cover. You know, that was a trouble, right? You can't fit all of them on a cover. And so for this one, we just went with astronaut. I think it kind of encompasses all the letters. But I think somewhere in here, there probably is all those letters. It's just incredible, right? So it really does show you. The thing is, to be an astronaut, you almost have to be in every person. Like, you have to have done a little bit of everything, and they have to bring that life experience, that engineering experience, that science experience. And what's scary is sometimes they actually hire someone who's like 28 who has that kind of experience, right? And you're like, what was I doing at 28?
Right, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Not the right thing, apparently, right?
Yeah. I'm still trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up. So it's going to be interesting, yeah. Yeah. What I don't understand about these astronauts too is that like they accomplish all these things, which are like all like just not things you get by accident. They're all like deliberative, time intensive, you know, activities, becoming a doctor, becoming a pilot, becoming an astronaut, all these things. And like somehow they still have like decent social skills and they can like, you know, go to a party and talk to people. I'm like, when did you get all this practice having friends? Because like you should have been reading books for 27 hours a day. I don't get it. I don't understand.
But when you're cooped up in a small space with them, believe me, you want social skills. You know, I keep harkening back to those 2 weeks I did on a simulated Mars mission a few years ago. And yeah, social skills are challenging in that situation because you're tired, you know, you're plastered in dust all the time. And there are human beings in there and there's no privacy. You know, you got to figure out how to work. It's tough.
Yeah.
It's cool. Much like writing a book with somebody, I'm sure.
Yeah. You know what? Similar. It was good to have somebody who's an astronaut in that respect, right? Because we just got it. We just got it whenever the other was feeling a little bit tired or a little bit stressed. We just knew a little bit about how to step away, you know, in those moments. But it all came together. That was the important thing. Like, just like any mission, we were saying, okay, we got a deadline. We got to get through these steps and we're going to figure it out together, no matter what it takes. And, you know, I'm really, really lucky to have had Dave, my co-author, and twice even, and I can even say a third time almost with Canadarma Collaboration, because he was the guy who wrote the foreword. And so, you know, it's through collaborations like that, it was unintentionally citing the book, but anyway, it's through that you get mentorship. And then my job now is to go and turn it around for somebody else at that in the future. So that's my challenge. I'm going, oh my goodness, now I've got to borrow all this experience from Dave. Now I got to give it to somebody else. And so I'll have to think through carefully about what that would be, you know, in the future. But who knows? I may be giving somebody who's, you know, 10 or 12 right now in the 10 or so years a phone call and say, hey, let's work on a book together. This is what Dave told me, and now I got to tell you, right? So yeah, I got to think this one through.
I'm not doing a book, so Jake can do it.
I'm talking about somebody who's a preteen now, right?
Well, but Jake still knows what he wants to be, so...
Yeah, I still don't know what I want to be. Yeah, but.
He's shapeable still. He's sculptable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you tell us real quick, space.com? You are
space.com.
A staff writer there now.
I am a staff writer there.
Previously, you were only a contributing writer, I believe.
Yes. So I was a freelancer there for 10 whole years. And I was a stubborn one because I was living in Canada. And I still am living in Canada, and they cleverly are in the United States, right? Because obviously that's where much of the space industry is. And so for me to become a staff writer for many years, I would have had to leave my life up here, which I suppose wasn't a bad thing. But at the same time, I've got a house, I've got a husband, luckily, and you know, I'm kind of tied here. And so we just had these back and forth conversations for a few years about how best I could suit the site and help them out. And what ended up happening was, a little pandemic, right? And so it's all affected us in different ways. But one of the ways in which this really has affected space.com was they realized, you know what, remote work is a very possible thing. And I mean, it's funny to say, obviously, because they are aware of space exploration and the potential there, but they just changed their modality of working a little bit and said, you know what, some of us could be in the office some of the time, some of us can be away from the office, we can come together as need be, and then we can go back again. And so they generously brought me on, you know, and they said, you can stay from Canada. It actually says in my contract that I have to be, you know, based in Canada for this thing to work, which I really like, you know. So that's what I'm doing now. I'm a staff writer full time. My job is spaceflight. This podcast is running later today, I suppose. So if you go back a few hours, you can see that I, on behalf of the organization, got to call the International Space Station, which is incredible. That was another team effort between NASA, space.com, myself. I was just a voice on the phone, but there were a lot of other people involved. And then what we're also trying to do is constantly be engaging the community, you know, thinking of really innovative ways and fun ways to be bringing in new readers and to be talking about stuff, you know, whether it's sci-fi, gaming, Prime Day, which is ongoing right now. It's another way of engaging people through binoculars, telescopes, Lego sets. There's lots of Lego sets you should be getting right now, folks, because as one of our stories says, some are going to be disappearing. That Saturn V that I got right beside my desk here isn't going to be a thing for much longer. So, you know, so anyway,
finally have to spend money really, on that. Damn it.
Yeah, exactly, right? So seriously, what I really like about the site, having been there for 10 years as a freelancer and about 3 months as a person who's full-time, is that we do cover a variety of topics. You know, we're not just in one small pigeonhole of the space community. We're always trying to get bigger and think about new ways to be finding people. And so I guess my takeaway message is that, you know, if in your own life you just love space in some kind of niche way, understand that, you know, there are folks out there that want to hear about it. You know, even if you really are into space comic books, there's a market for that. Believe me. So
we know about niches. We do niches.
Yeah, we all do niches. Exactly. Yeah.
You had one post a couple of days ago about No Man's Sky coming to Nintendo Switch.
Yeah, and that's exactly it.
I opened this one up and I audibly said, ah, shit. Like, I've seen an impending productivity loss for me right there. I'm like, God damn it.
Well, that's the thing, right? But it's a productivity loss in the service of space. You got to realize that. It's a different class of productivity. It's for work.
That's what I'm going to say.
Of your spirit and the service of your spirit.
I say that every time I buy a Fortnite skin. It is for the service of the space community. This $10 that I'm letting go of right now, right?
Katie's going to be like, what are you doing? I'm like, it's for work.
It's for work. It's 100% for work. I'm looking good at the same time, too. So,
Jake, do you got anything on the way out here?
Well, I'm trying to do the time math for when this will happen and what
violation.
I will have done. And that's challenging. So I am trying to get an episode out later this week, maybe next week. I'm on Voyager. I haven't really done Voyager before. And so I'm trying to do some interviews and they had like a little bit of an attitude control problem. So I'm trying to dig into that. And
has it left the solar system yet or?
You know, I don't know. I don't know if I know that answer.
Yeah.
It depends on what you mean by solar system.
Left.
How about
it again?
That?
Exactly. How many times has it left?
Yeah.
It's left three or four times,
I'm not
going
to do this on the air, but I just would say there's a nuance between leaving the solar system and going into interstellar space. Look it up.
And boy, do we know every nuance now through Voyager.
Exactly, right? But it's way out there. We can say that much. And I'm glad that it's communicating again, at least somewhat, you know, because... that thing launched even before I was born. I don't know about the two of you, but I can't believe that, you know, and it's still going. Yeah. Like how many cars are still going after that long? Phew.
Not that many.
Point. That's machines, generally machines.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
That's true.
What about you, Anthony? What do you got going on?
Well, as I mentioned on our previous show, Jake, the Astrobotic Spectacular
is out.
It'll be out. People will be able to hear it. This is going to be a 2-hour show, Jake.
Jeez.
Like I forgot how many conversations I had at Astrobotic, but I got home and I was like, oh wow, this is gonna be a long one. So it's it's pretty great. I talked to the mission manager, project managers on different teams at Astrobotic, talked to the executive director of the Moonshot Museum that is in the front of Astrobotic's headquarters. It's an awesome show. And I guess there was some more recent news that ULA finally officially delayed the launch of Vulcan out of this year.
Yes.
So, shocker.
Yes.
So
everyone is so surprised. Yeah.
The Astrobotic Spectacular. We talked about it on Off Nominal, obviously, in my visit, but now you get to actually hear the people chatting about what they're working on. So
sweet.
It's worth
sweet.
It. So check it out, peeps. Yeah. Awesome.
All right. Well, Elizabeth, this was awesome. Thanks so much for popping on and sharing your new book. It's a really fun read. It's not a difficult one. It's like not a slog in any way. So it's a really, really approachable book. Lots of fun. And you can read more about Footbits. So I recommend everyone go get it. And
stop saying Footbits. God.
I will not stop saying Footbits.
ECWpress.com.
Yeah.
Get it.
Exactly.
Get it, peeps.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both of you. Really appreciate it. Take care.
Yeah.
See y'all.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. End of test.